And when the person says, well, why are we doing this? They go, well, you don't need to know why, just go do it. Well, that's ridiculous.
Well, would you even call them a leader if that's what they're doing?
No, I would call them a manager.
I would call them an unemployed person.
I would call them a manager who's pissing everyone off.
Yeah.
Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay.
This is Sell or Die, and I'm Jen Gluckow, founder and CEO of Sales in a New York Minute. And on my left
is the great, oh, that's humble, Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling. And we are going to talk to you about you today, and we have an amazing show scheduled. We have a lot of things that we want to cover, but what are you doing, Jenny?
Well, we have an incredible guest coming up on the show. Forget the guest. He's so great.
Well, I don't want to overplay
Let's
him.
Just
He's from
say
Philly.
His name.
He's already got the ego going on. It's the great Sean Doyle, but first, you're going to love the guy. Second of all, he makes sense in so many human ways.
Oh, yeah. He's going to talk to us about culture in the workplace, leadership, and even grief.
And don't be fooled, by the way. This is going to apply to you, and it will impact you for an extended period of time. It has impacted us, and we don't impact very easily.
Before we get to that, I have to tell you about amazing new service we're using, StrasburgerSteaks.com. It's revolutionizing the way people across the country are eating meat.
You may not know that you can get steakhouse quality prime meat delivered to your door, no trip to the store necessary. Now, I'm talking tender, delicious New York strip steak, mouthwatering rib steak, porterhouse, veal chops, and they're very famous, world famous, bone-in filet. I'm hungry.
Strasburger meats are in the kitchen of some of New York's world-famous steakhouses like Keen's Chop House, Smith & Walensky, and Lavo. If you've ever had an unforgettable steak in New York City, it was a Strasburger steak.
Listen, salespeople around the world, the Strasburgers have been in the meat business since the 1850s. They know meat. Once you've tried one of their amazing steaks, there's no going back.
It makes a great gift for any celebration, birthdays, holidays, even corporate giveaways. Give the gift of an unforgettable steak from the people who have been doing it the longest, or keep it all to yourself. Visit StrasburgerSteaks.com today and click on the Steak Lover button to bring the steakhouse to your house. I want to talk to you today, before we get into the interview, about referability.
Okay.
And what makes someone referable. And I'll tell you why I want to talk about this. I think it's really important in sales right now. It's harder and harder to make cold pitches, whether they be cold calls or emails. And the easier thing is obviously to just get referred.
I agree. But the experts, or the so-called experts, are pretty much full of bullshit when it comes to referral, because they will all tell you, ask for referrals. Here's how you ask for referrals, which means basically you're a taker and you may not even be referable. So I'd like to really start our discussion by saying, are you even a referable human being? What makes you referable as a human being?
Okay.
And I think about the people that I refer to. In other words, I'm willing to give Walter Putnam a referral because I trust Walter Putnam, because he's a value person to me, because he has proven himself over a period of time.
Now, let me ask you a question. Has Walter, let's just use Walter as an example.
Yeah,
has Walter always done what he says he's going to do?
100%. 110%.
How is that possible?
I don't know, but he's been my financial planner now for probably 15 years or more. And one of his records is he's never come over to our place without me having to sign a document. But it's fun. Even when he takes us out to dinner, by the way, there's something to sign.
I totally
love that. But he's so good. He's so thorough.
By the way, once he had to bring a book just so he couldn't break that record.
Yeah. He's so knowledgeable that if anybody needs anything, he's the first person I think of.
So you trust that he's going to do a good job to whoever
I'm willing to risk the relationship that I have with my friend in order to give them to Walter. That's how much I trust the guy.
You're really risking the trust factor, because if you make a bad referral, they're not going to trust you so much anymore to refer someone else.
Right. Now, I also will tell you that I trust Scott Meniker. Mm. He's my dentist. And I have referred so many people there that as I'm going out one day, I bought a Sonicare for $100 or whatever. And the Ashley says, oh, you don't owe any money. That's what he means. She goes, oh, you have a referral account. Seriously? Like, I didn't even know. You know what I mean? I didn't do it for the money. I did it because he's the best. So I think in order to be referred, you have to be a great person. You have to be proven over time. You have to show that you're a value person, not a taker person. You have to be able to provide immediate and solid quality service.
So I needed something from my banker today, Darren Kay.
Yeah.
And he's definitely someone I would refer and have referred times and times over. But I knew he was on vacation because he gave me a heads up about a week ago. And so I texted him and said, sorry, I know you're on vacation, but who should I contact? He's out of the country and he called me to make it happen.
Cool.
So that's how you know.
No, he called you just to rub it in. Like, I'm out of the country and you're not.
But that's how you know you're dealing with someone of high caliber who is there for you and is going to make it happen.
When I give someone my cell phone number, I say sometimes I'm out of the area, sometimes I'm even out of the country. If I'm out of the time zone and you text me and I'm sleeping, I'll fake like I'm awake. And it's funny, but it's also a reference to how I serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm responsive. Mm-hmm. And that referable person must be responsive and must be available on an immediate basis. And you can count on two hands the number of people that you know that are immediately responsive. You know exactly who they are.
Yeah, 100%. So Jim, one of my friends from New York who does promotional products and printing.
Yeah, love Jim.
Love Jim. He's great. So Jim, when he makes a referral, he offers, if they're both in New York, to take the two people to lunch.
Mm-hmm.
How cool is that?
Well,
so it's not just like Jeffrey meet Doug, Doug meet Jeffrey. It's Jeffrey and Doug, please meet. Here's why I think you can do work together.
Right.
And let's sit down for lunch. It's on me.
Yep, pizza.
It's not always on him, but you know.
Well, people go, no, I got it. It's like, I got it, man.
But look at what a value provider he comes off being, because now he's making these amazing connections.
If the person who gives you a referral is not willing to call that person and set a meeting and say, I'm going to refer Jennifer to you because she's the greatest, then it's not really a referral.
Oh, you mean like...
It's a lead. It's a lead.
If they say something like, hey, Jeffrey, I think you should call my friend Tom because Tom could really use your services.
Yeah, that ain't a referral.
Okay, great.
That's
now introduce me.
Yeah. A referral is somebody that you're willing to meet on a three-way phone call or a three-way cup of coffee or a lunch or a meal. And the person who is referring makes that call.
So I have a little pet peeve. I have to go off on this for a second. Referrals.
Exactly.
And, you know, I've made a bunch of introductions recently for someone. Mm-hmm. And so have you, actually. And what bothers me is when you make this introduction and you know the other person on the other end is ready to buy from the person that you're making the introduction for.
And they don't call right away.
But the person who you've made it for doesn't call right away, doesn't email response right away, doesn't follow up right away. So, that pisses me off.
No. You stop referring.
Oh, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, no, I am actually done because that pisses me off. You just made me look bad.
However.
Like, I went out of my way.
However, just set a three-way call. And that way
it was suggested in the email.
No. You set the call.
Let's all talk.
Those are famous last words. It was suggested in the email.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Some of my best friends are. I think that you have to look at this from the perspective of you take responsibility for the referral because you're taking the risk. You're referring Bob Jones over to Harry or Mary. And you say, hey, Bob, I'm going to set a call with this with Mary. I'd like you to be on the call.
So being the New Yorker that I am, I'm going to be sending follow-up emails to say, how did it go with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? Because we just made these four introductions that should have kicked ass. And I can't wait to hear the response.
Yeah, me neither. You bastard. Okay, so.
Is it time for the interview yet?
Yeah. I think we should get to Sean Doyle. I think that Sean is a great guy. He's a Philly guy.
Sean is freaking awesome. I'm reading his book, just for the record. Hold on. I have it down here. It's called The Sun Still Rises. He's written a couple books, I think. But the one I'm reading is Surviving and Thriving After Grief and Loss. My grandma recently passed away, and someone handed me this book about a week or so, or a couple days after it happened, randomly. And he's a great writer. He's a great communicator, and he can teach you how to be a great leader.
So without further ado, please help me welcome the great Sean Doyle. Sean, welcome to the show. You're now officially a sell or die guest, and we want to treat you like one. In spite of the fact that you come from the city of unbrotherly love. Oh, I mean brotherly love. I get that mixed up sometimes.
But Jeffrey.
Only when I go to the airport.
Yeah.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. Can you give the our listening audience a little bit of a background on how you became the great Sean Doyle, CSP?
It's actually kind of an interesting story. I was in sales originally when I started my career, and I liked it, but I must admit that I didn't love it. And so what happened was, one year I actually volunteered to give a presentation at a national meeting for a company. And I guess I knocked it out of the park, because 2 weeks later the phone rang and it was the director of training for the company and offered me a job in training and development. And I swear to you, within 2 weeks, it was like the clouds opened up and a ray of sun came down and said, "This is your path. This is your life's
cool.
work.
Cool.
Way to go. That's amazing.
That. 28 years. Been doing that now.
Wow. And when did you quit that company?
Well, I left that company and went to another larger company, and I started my own firm 14 years ago, actually last month.
So it was about 6 or 7 years working for other people, and then you decided, the heck with this. It's not profitable enough. I can make way more money on my own.
Well, I started hiring speakers to speak at national meetings and regional meetings. And when I saw what kind of money they were making, I'm like, I could do this.
Well, and did you just see how much money they were making, or did you judge it in terms of yourself saying, I'm better than that guy?
I just thought because of all my experience, I just thought I had a lot of expertise I could share. The other interesting thing that happened was, whenever I do training, I'd always sneak in motivational stuff, even though I wasn't supposed to. Mm-hmm. I'd get ready to go, wow, you need to do more of that motivational stuff. I mean, I could literally do a program on anything, and I would sneak in a little module on motivation.
So what are some of your secrets to motivation?
Yeah.
I think you guys said that in stereo. The first thing is, I really do believe this at the core of my being, is you have to have a passion for what you do. If you don't, as I say in my book, Jumpstart Your Motivation, get out and go do something else. Because there's way too many miserable people that I meet in public who are just miserable. And I don't understand why you would choose be miserable and not to pursue your passion.
So when you come into the Philadelphia airport, do you see a sign that says miserable is a choice?
No, he's carrying the sign.
Oh, hey, listen, it's where I grew up. I get it. There are a ton of people there who don't quite get the fact that happiness is a choice, or that personal good feeling is a choice. And they tend to, you know, bump into you and say, get the hell out of my way, instead of excuse me.
And it's true across the country. I mean, I just meet so many people who have chosen to stay in what it is they're doing, but they're not happy. They're not passionate. They're just kind of going through the motions. And to me, life is too short to just kind of go through the motions. I mean, do what you love.
Do you have a couple of sayings that you used, a couple of pearls of wisdom that you'd like to share with our audience who may be a little bit unmotivated today?
Yeah. Probably the biggest one is the one that I just mentioned, is if you don't like what you're doing, get out. Mm-hmm. Go do something else. Because, well, I don't have any control. I'm like, and the other one I always say is, you're the architect of your own life. If you're dissatisfied with your life, one of the reasons you're dissatisfied with your life is you built it. Hello. You built it and you can change it.
Check your bricks.
Yeah, but that's so much easier to say than do, don't you think?
Very difficult. But my father has a great saying. He's a brilliant man, 83 years old, and still at 83, a realtor. And one saying that he has is people build fences and then they blame other people for their limitations, but they're the ones who built the fence. I think limitation is, and you see this, I'm sure both of you see this all the time in your practice, is people that have the limited thinking, that they're the ones who installed it.
Yeah, but sometimes the people have this hesitation because of fear of change based on, I have a mortgage, I have a car payment, I got three kids, I got to go to college. And they're not willing to really take that leap of faith or that.
Where I know what I have, I don't know what I'm going to get if I go someplace else.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Like the devil I know is better than the devil I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that's a huge error. And, you know, I meet lots of people who tell me their stories behind the scenes. I met a lady recently who, you know, loves to bake. And I said, well, why don't you bake for a living? And she's like, oh, it's too risky. And I said, well, start doing it on the weekend. You know, launch a website, you know, do it part-time first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That transitional phase, you know, then eventually you make enough money to make the leap. It's not like you have to be all in all at once. It can be a process.
Oh, that's a good way. I think
the internet has given people an ability to walk across a bridge instead of taking a leap across the creek or the river. Mm-hmm.
Breaking down those fences you're referring to.
Without a doubt, yeah.
So talk to us about your book. I started reading it. It's about surviving and thriving after grief and loss. It's called The Sun Still Rises. We have a copy here.
Yeah.
But this is not just about grief and loss. It's also about motivation, isn't it?
It is. And Jennifer, thank you for that question. The book is written on my very painful personal experience. I was married for, as you know, for 32 years. And sadly, one night, quite unexpectedly, my wife died tragically. So at the age of 54, you know, I went from being married, you know, and thought my whole life would be being married to this person, literally to overnight, you know, waking up the next day a widower at the age of 54. And so I basically had to figure it all out. You know, and the problem with our society is nobody talks about this topic. Nobody addresses this topic and no one really has any answers.
So mm-hmm. I said, unless it's happened to them, then they want to know.
Right.
Exactly. So I started looking for answers in the first place. I looked because I'm an author and a speaker, obviously, as I started looking for other books on grief and found tons of them and read many of them. What I really started doing was, you know, okay, Mr. Motivational speaker, book author, can you apply this to your own life? Now, what happened was my publisher noticed that I was healing very nicely on my grief journey. And so they said, you know, would you be willing to write a book about grief? I never thought I would, but I said, well, I'd like to give that a shot. And so I thought about all the crazy things that I did to heal, maybe not crazy, but different. And put them into book form. And I literally get emails every week from people around the world saying this book helped me heal. And that's...
Wow. So is there like a six-step process to healing or what do you recommend?
There's stages of grief that were outlined by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in a book called On Death and Dying. I'm not particularly a fan of the stages of grief because I think whenever you say there's supposed to be stages, then people feel bad because,
exactly. Oh, wait, I'm not following the book. This must be wrong.
So I'm not necessarily a fan of the stages, but I do think there's things that you can do to heal. And the first one is something I came up with called the joy list. And it's literally a list of things that bring you joy. And I literally wrote out, I sat on a beach with a journal and I wrote out, what are all the things that bring me joy? And then what I did is every week I tried to roll in some of those joy things because I could be in grief, but at least for a moment or two, I could be in joy.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When they first came out with video games, they called it a joystick.
Oh yeah.
And there's a reason for it. You could have called it the dipstick, or but they decided that they wanted to make it a positive thing. And look at the meme that they created with that.
Mm-hmm.
Great point. So it's just, you know, thinking about what can you do, because often when people are grieving, they just sit around and stare at the wall.
Yeah.
I need to get out. I need to go do stuff. I need to be with people. I need to heal. And so I actually was very proactive about my healing as opposed to waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. You had a line in the book where you said someone called you and you were out shopping and they asked, where are you? And you said, oh, I'm out shopping. And they had this judgment like, shopping? I guess you're not grieving if you're shopping.
Yeah, you must be. In order for you to really fully do this, you have to sit home and do nothing for 10 years.
Yeah. And I think life's, I mean, as I learned, life is too short.
Yeah.
So why not be shopping or be at an amusement park or be wherever, be at the beach and trying to, you know, regain joy as opposed to.
Sure. Do you address that at all in your speaking?
I actually do. Even in my leadership programs, I do tell the story because I really believe that it's an important lesson about how to overcome adversity.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think no matter what you do, if you're in sales, you're in sales management, no matter what you do, you're going to have adversity. I don't know why adversity is a surprise to people. Like, oh, I'm surprised adversity happened.
Yeah, holy mackerel, yeah. Why didn't my mother live to 120? That's what I want to know. Let me give you a thought that occurred to me as we're sitting here. I grew up a big Peanuts fan, Charles Schulz.
Love Peanuts.
And if you look at the Charlie Brown word bubbles, whenever he says the word grief, he puts the word good in front of it. Good grief. And I think that that's something that you should look at and try to tag to people that grief can be good. It doesn't have to be depression. It doesn't have to be going to a shrink. It doesn't have to be sitting around moping or kicking doors or whatever. Why did this? Oh God! Why did this happen to me? No, it's good grief.
I like that, Jeffrey.
I think that if you're looking at the motivational aspect of this, you should look at other memes that you can bring into your talk that I think would enable the audience to see the other side of it, because that's really what you're trying to do, right?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And the other thing that's interesting is there's one chapter in the book called Myths About Grief. And one of the myths is that grief is just bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But if you're paying attention, it could actually be good. You know, what can you learn? You know, how can you increase your appreciation of life? And those kinds of things. So I agree with you.
Cool. Maybe you should, when you reprint the book, you should put the good grief thing in there with Charlie Brown on it.
Yeah, I'm sure that won't cost me anything.
I've learned in life with those kind of things, it's better to get forgiveness than permission.
Oh, no. Do not listen to him.
Sorry, Sean.
I think Randy Glassbergen, who did the cartoons for your website, would not say that, right?
No, well,
you
I'll
paid
tell you,
him.
I paid Randy Glassbergen a hell of a lot of money. Yeah.
He's a brilliant cartoonist.
Yeah. He passed away as well just a couple of years ago. We had a great relationship. He was easy to access, just wonderful. And sometimes we had to adjust his, the cartoon humor to make it fit what I was trying to do. But it was as long as I paid him, he was the happiest guy on the planet.
Okay.
And also in advance, I should say that.
So Randy was great. Sean, I want to get back to you.
Sorry, yeah.
So you are a motivation and leadership expert. How did you get into the field of leadership?
Yeah.
It occurred to me when I was in corporate America, particularly, I worked for a Fortune 100 company, and we had a massive leadership development program. We had one program for people that wanted to be leaders. We had a program that people that were, the kind of like supervisors. We had one program for managers and directors, and we had one program for executives. But
training programs?
Yeah, comprehensive, long-term, intense leadership development programs. And I had an epiphany. I love that word, epiphany.
Yeah.
I had an epiphany, and the epiphany is this. And this is true with every organization that I work with. If people are good at something, they're good at sales, right? And you guys see this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They get promoted to sales manager.
Right, without any training.
Mm-hmm. And they assume that the competencies are the same as they were for being a salesperson. And that is so untrue. And so I said, where's the biggest gap? And I think the biggest gap is these poor folks across the world who get promoted to being a manager, and they don't know how.
Yeah. Or they don't understand the difference between what they did and what they have to do now. I think that's the biggest gap there.
Yeah. So what would you tell a salesperson gone sales manager?
I think the very first thing they have to do is either through book form or webinar or classes or whatever, they have to learn the core competencies of leadership, everything from coaching to motivating to delegating, to all those things, right?
I noticed you didn't include the word manager in there. I'm anti the word manager. I think you should either be a leader or a coach or get out.
Yeah, I agree. I often change around and say mangler.
Yeah. What I tell people is if you want to manage somebody, manage yourself. And then turn yourself into a leader or a coach, because that's who they're going to. No one wants to be managed, but everybody would like to be led or coached.
No, exactly. So I agree with you. So I think that's the huge gap. And I mean, I meet these poor people who, you know, I go to a leadership training program, and you know, they've been in a leadership role for 10 years, not one day learning how to do it.
So what's the first thing you would teach them?
Management versus leadership.
Cool.
Okay.
We're on the same page there.
I like that. Yeah.
You know, what's the difference? And a lot of people don't understand the difference at all.
Mm-hmm. And so if you've been managing for 10 years, how do you then take that switch over to become a leader?
One of the things that I often say is the biggest difference between management and leadership is focusing on people and management is focusing on things.
Mm-hmm.
If you can really focus on the people development side, I mean, there's sales managers and people that are going to be listening to this across the world. If they just focused on the people side, could massively increase their sales like that just by focusing on developing every single person on their team.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to throw an example and then you can talk about it, or I wish you would talk about it. I don't necessarily want the people that I teach in management to teach their salespeople how to sell. I want to teach them how to think and how to succeed.
Good.
How to sell becomes a hell of a lot easier once you talk at the 30,000 foot level, because they didn't come into this management thing, boy, I sure hope my salespeople can sell a lot.
Right.
No, I want to be a success. I got a house payment. I don't want to win this one for the Gipper. I want to win this for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's how everyone feels.
That's correct. Yep. And so I think the biggest thing is setting down with each person that reports to you, creating a individual development plan.
Cool.
Here's where they are and here's where they need to be, and coming up with the steps in order to help them get there, whatever their goal may be.
Yeah, I'm not going to say sell 50,000 a month or die. I'm going to say you're not making enough money at this, and here's how you can make more money. I'd rather create that plan than the make 100 calls a day.
Or what about asking if you're the manager leader, what about asking your salesperson, what would it mean to you to have X more sales? What would it, you know, what would you get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, I think that's a great point. Far too seldom do leaders ever say or talk about the why.
Mm.
Why are you doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Because I sold widgets. I'm like, no, but why?
Yeah. Well, because I want my customers to up their order.
Right. And why?
Yeah.
Why, right. It's like that exercise, the five whys. That's pretty powerful.
Right. You know? Edwards Deming had it right. And he brought it to America, but we still don't use it.
Yeah. Why should you work out? You know, it's like, well, gee, yeah, because I should work out, but why?
Yeah. Well, I want to get in better shape. Well, why? Well, because I want to socialize more. Well, why? Because, you know, once you hit the fifth why, you pretty much got it.
Yep. Hmm. That's right.
And I remind people of their why rather than remind them of their skill set not being as good as it can be.
Exactly. And that leader who, you know, tells people what to do, and when the person says, well, why are we doing this? They go, well, you don't need to know why, just go do it. Well, that's ridiculous.
Well, would you even call them a leader if that's what they're doing?
No, I would call them a manager.
I would call them an unemployed person.
I would call them a manager who's pissing everyone off.
Yeah.
I've reported to many of them in my life.
It's unbelievable how many people think their boss is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, amazing. A survey where they said that 40% of the people don't trust the person they report to you.
We like to use the number 74%, Sean. So don't just banter around a number unless you can support it.
It's only Forbes.com, not very credible.
I would tell you, though, how if I ask my audiences in a public seminar, how many of you have ever worked for a jerk? Every single person raises their hand. And I said, well, how many of you, your boss is actually in the audience? And that it gets a big laugh. But the reality of it is that a lot of bosses are jerks, or a lot of bosses preach the wrong strategies to be able to get their people to perform. And then they blame it on the people.
That's right.
How would you help them if they're jerky leaders?
Yeah. How do you help a jerk?
Well, I was in a, the first part is jerks are often unaware that they're jerks.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we need to correct that blind spot. One of the things that I use, which is really effective, is leadership assessments.
Mm-hmm.
Leadership assessment with a 360. And when I sit down with that individual one-on-one and go, well, geez, the numbers are real low, and here are the comments that people, and they're shocked.
Meaning their employees have rated them as a leader.
Right. Yes. Or okay. Not as a leader. But do they actually... You go over the leadership 360 with them. Are they saying, no, that's not true, and they go back to blame the people?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
You had 19 people give feedback, direct reports, people that you report to, vendors, suppliers, et cetera. You can't argue with this data.
Right.
I mean, what does this data mean, and why is it important for you to know it? It's fascinating.
I think that the 360 thing, which has been in existence for decades.
Long time.
Is pretty much useless if no one does anything about it once they get it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why there's not more holding feet to the fire to be able to do something about it, because oftentimes there's not.
There's a lot of companies that will call me in to do a half day or a full day of training, a topic. And then my question to the leadership team always is, what are you going to do before the class?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do after the class? And they go, well, what do you mean? We're doing the class. I'm like, but what do you do after the class? They're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, accountability, discussions about what they learned,
yep.
Action plans, but yep. They don't get that.
Well, you have to do something or you're not really a leader anyway.
Exactly. So I'm not sure why companies still tolerate leadership and competence. That's my big question. I've been thinking lately is, why do companies tolerate a jerk leader?
Yeah. Why don't you write the book? Hey, you're a jerk, but you just don't know it.
I actually have an article I'm writing next week for Inc.com. I write for them weekly. And the one I'm writing about is leadership hypocrisy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Hypocritical is saying, well, these are our values and this is our mission and vision. We don't do it. We're jerks, but we expect everybody else to treat our employees with respect and recognize their work.
Do you get much response from that Inc. magazine article?
I do. I write for actually several large websites. I write for HuffPost,
mm-hmm.
I write for Inc. I write for Entrepreneur, and I write for the Goodman Project. But I often get emails from people saying, hey, I read your book, The 9 Secrets of Happy People, and I'd like you to come and speak at our meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
That's good.
All right. So give us one secret of a happy person.
By far, to me, one of the biggest ones is actually having clearly articulated goals.
Ooh.
They're not just getting up in the morning doing stuff. They're doing stuff with a purpose and a vision. And they know why, back to the why, right? But they know why they're doing it.
And a passion, correct?
Absolute passion. Yep.
I mean, I don't think Steve Jobs ever woke up and said, hey, it's Wednesday. I don't know what I'm going to do today. I think he pretty much went and worked his ass off all day long.
And he definitely had clear goals.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He had vision and balls. And I think that's part of what leaders need, more balls.
Now, is it a rule you bring that up on every podcast, Jeffrey? I was just curious.
No, I don't. I only...
Vision and balls or Steve Jobs?
With Philadelphia. I only bring up balls with Philadelphia people because they are born with them. They just don't always use them.
Okay. I was just curious. No, I think, when we look at people that we admire, the Richard Bransons,
yep.
The Anthony Robbins, the Sheryl Sandbergs, the Mary Kay going way back, in the day.
Yeah. We may admire different people, but everybody has someone that they admire. And yes. I have a Steve Jobs business card framed on my desk. I see it every time I sit down or every time I go through my office.
Wow.
It's inspirational because this is a person who changed a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm looking to change anything, that I have to think of myself as, okay, where's the vision? Where's the hard work? Where's the team or the family of people that I'm surrounding myself with? And how am I going to get this done? Because I have a short space of time.
No, absolutely. And I loved what Steve Jobs has said about, you know, leaving a dent in the universe.
Yep.
I thought that was just such a great way of saying it. And he did.
Oh, totally. And the dent.
He left more than a dent.
Yeah. The dent is still there. If you go to an Apple store, you can't even see the floor. There's so many people in there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's really
out of his imagination, you know.
I hate to tell you, but this has really been a good interview. And we would love to have you back again, maybe to narrow down subjects like leadership or motivation.
Yeah.
But for the moment, I really want to thank you for your time and your wisdom.
You're very welcome.
We will spread the Sean Doyle word.
So if people want more from you, should they go to SeanDoyle.com? SeanDoyleMotivates.com?
Yeah, they could go to SeanDoyleMotivates.com and all my contact information is there and blogs and video clips and all sorts of stuff.
Get this book, The Sun Still Rises. I'm reading it. It's great.
Thank you.
So our people will call your people, Sean. And
Thank you, Sean.
I'll see you in Philadelphia for a steak sandwich. And
we'll
talk about it from there.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, Jen, that guy is brilliant.
He's great. You know, he went through such a traumatic experience, and he didn't go into depth about it, but I am reading his book, and he walked home from a business trip, said hi to his wife, and literally next thing he knows, she's saying, call an ambulance. And then by the time the ambulance got there, she was out. I mean, that's traumatic. And for him to be such a happy guy, helping others learn how to be happy, be motivated, get inspired, it's amazing.
Well, he taught himself how to be happier and how to recover.
Mm-hmm.
He taught himself the grieving process and then realized that some of the things were missing and wrote a book about it.
Mm-hmm. No, well, he noticed a lot of the things were missing or wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had a very interesting discussion on not just the leadership and the motivational thing, but what happens when something goes wrong? Mm-hmm. How do you fix what you can't change?
Mm-hmm.
Death is unchangeable.
Yeah.
And
a lot of people think being in their job is unchangeable.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a lot of people die.
they do, but.
Yeah, it is unchangeable, but you can change you don't have to change things in your company. You can get up and walk out.
Yeah, but it's not that simple. I was at a company where I was happy for the first 5 years, and the last year and a half of my life, I became a different person because I wasn't happy at my job.
Well, I determined early on in life that I was not going to be a good employee for anybody. And so I had to start my own company. And I did that literally from the time I was 20. I worked for people before I was 20 and never afterwards.
But anytime you got bored of what you were doing or you weren't excited about it anymore, changed what you were doing.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. Because you knew you could.
Or I
grew
into
it. You had all that history of past success.
Well, that's true. But let me share something else. My parents were successful. And that gave me the belief system that, well, if my parents could do it, I'm just as smart as they are, I can do it too. So I didn't look at it simply as, oh, I'm worried about this. I looked at where my family was, realized where they were, and I just took the leap of, not just the leap of faith, but the leap of confidence.
Yeah, I have that similar confidence ingrained in me because it's the same reason.
Yeah, exactly.
But I know a lot of people who grow up whose parents were successful and they don't have that confidence. No. They don't think that they can personally be successful.
Wrong exit. So I guess as we wrap this particular show up, which is a pretty damn good one, I would challenge you that the belief system that you have in your soul is the belief system that's going to manifest itself in your own personal happiness and in your bank account. What do you think?
I like that.
Okay. Signing off today, our producers.
We got to thank them.
Doug Branson and Chris Hill are out there sweating their little buttons off.
Yes, our producer Doug Branson, our technical director Chris Hill, thank you guys.
We're being monitored today by Doug Sandler, who is Mr. Fricking Podcast himself.
He's Mr. Nice Guy.
He is Mr. Nice Guy. In fact, he has the book called Mr. Nice Guy.
Nice Guys Finished First.
Oh, yeah.
And the podcast, Nice Guys on Business.
Yep, and it's very successful, and he will be...
you like that plug? Come on, yeah. That's a good plug. You're exactly. Not even in the room here. He's just sitting, hanging out, telling us how to be better.
Right, in a sarcastic kind of Washington, D.C. kind of way. But it's working, and we're very appreciative of it and appreciative of him.
Yeah. So if you like our show, subscribe, rate, and review. Give us that 5-star review
on iTunes. Yeah, and tell both your friends.
Until next time, I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, reminding you to get out there and sell even if your ass falls off.